Take that!
This is Hunting Humbug 101 with me, Theo Clark, and I'm joined with my co-host, Ben. Ben, how are you going?
Hi, Theo. I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
Good. In this episode, we're actually going to... I've actually titled this one Talking Skeptically, so I'm not actually going to look at a particular fallacy. What I wanted to look at was just a way to engage with people who aren't skeptics, and just a couple of different approaches I've come across recently that mirror things I'd kind of worked out myself. So they're both examples from two different podcasts we're going to have a listen to. But before we do that, there's a kind of a section in some sections in the book that I wanted to cover as well from the introductory section. So they're not actually fallacies, but in particular, but they're about being a seeker after truth and also about Socratic wisdom, or sorry, the Socratic dialogue approach. So before we get into the audio clips in our discussion, let's have a read from a couple of sections from the book. Seekers after truth. Truth seeking involves both a habit of mind, a disinterested search of the truth, and a set of intellectual skills, the capacity to make a distinction between clay and another substance of similar color and texture. Humbug hunting is a way to foster one's critical thinking abilities to better seek the truth. It can be a rewarding and enjoyable pastime, but one needs to have the right attitude. Our enjoyment of hunting for humbug is founded on a well-honed sense of the ridiculous, an appreciation of unconscious irony, a readiness to engage in shameless hypocrisy, and a commitment to subverting the interests of those who manipulate people in ways detrimental to their own good. More importantly, the ultimate path to skepticism is to avoid as much as humanly possible investing in a particular belief or view. As a seeker after truth and critical thinker, one should invest in the process of truth-seeking, logic and reason, scientific evidence, and intellectual honesty, not the answers. This is what this book is about. The ancient Greek philosopher Socrates believed that the search for the truth was of the highest importance. He considered himself to be the gadfly that God had attached to the state of Athens. In his view, God had chosen him to interrogate the pretenders to wisdom. The oracle of Delphi had proclaimed that there were none wiser than Socrates. Socrates tested this by visiting those considered to be the wisest men of Athens. He found that as they were wise or knowledgeable in one area, they assumed this carried over into others. Through questioning, he found them to be oblivious to their own ignorance. They were in fact sophists. Socrates realized he was wiser than they, not because of what he knew, but because of what he was aware he didn't know.
So, sorry, Theo, if I can just butt in there. Just thinking, in the next edition, you might need to insert something about Diogenes in there. Do you know?
Oh, okay.
Do you know Diogenes? He was one of the.
I know the name, but I'm not sure what you're referring to specifically.
Okay. So Diogenes was one of the cynics. He might have even been the founder. Anyway, he was the guy who lived in a barrel in the street. He had no clothes or anything. He just used to wander around. Anyway, he was a contemporary of. Now let me get this straight. Which one of the philosophers was Alexander the Great's tutor? Was it Plato?
Was it
Aristotle?
Yeah, that was Plato. Yep.
So Diogenes was a contemporary of Plato.
Was it Plato or Aristotle? That was Plato, I think.
It was Plato, was it? Yeah. Well, anyway, he was a contemporary of whoever that was,
And here's another side note. I'm named by my parents after Theophrastus, who was after Aristotle.
Oh, he was he's offsider, was he?
He was a contemporary slash he took over the universe or the place they learned was called. Was it called the Lyceum? I can't remember the name of where they learned.
Lyceum or whatever.
Like that. Anyway, back to your story.
Are you making shit up, Theo, or is that true?
No, that's what they named me after. Yeah, Theophrastus. Yeah, look it up.
Okay. Anyway, Diogenes, there's this great, what's the word I'm looking for, Theo? Anecdote about Diogenes. One day they found him wandering around in the market square holding a lantern in the middle of the day. And so naturally they asked him what he was up to, and he said he was looking for a wise man. Sorry, I just...
No, I like it. That's great.
So basically,
see, we need more of that. The problem is if you did that Now you get locked up.
They would, yeah. So basically my point is Socrates was the same kind of person as Diogenes. He was like rocking the boat and annoying people.
And nothing bad happens if you do that, does it?
Well, nothing bad happened to Diogenes because Alexander the Great actually loved him quite a lot.
Oh, okay. But what Socrates, he was fine, right? Nothing happened to him?
Well, define fine for me, Theo.
Obviously, I'm joking, listeners. Socrates drank hemlock because he was being executed. But anyway. So I just need to interrupt the broadcast for a moment just to add in a couple of minor corrections. First of all, basically, whenever we're referring to factual information in the podcast, you probably should get onto Wikipedia and Google it because we do tend to make things up as we go along. Alexander the Great was actually tutored by Aristotle, not by Plato. So repeat, Alexander and Aristotle. And according to the fountain of all knowledge, that is Wikipedia, so Diogenes was as Ben said there, the kind of one of the founders of the Cynics, but he was a contemporary of Plato, and he criticized and embarrassed him, disputing his interpretations of Socrates, and he also sabotaged his lectures, sometimes distracting the attendees by bringing food and eating during the discussions. I know that I first found that distracting. Someone used to do that in the lecture. He was publicly responsible for mocking Alexander the Great, so fairly brave man. Apparently, it was in a meeting between Alexander and Diogenes in Corinth, and supposedly Alexander wanted to go meet him and ask him if he'd do him a favour, and he said, yes, stand out of my sunlight. Alexander then declared, if I were not Alexander, then I should wish to be Diogenes. To which Diogenes replied, well, if I were not Diogenes, I would also wish to be Diogenes. Another account of the conversation, Alexander found Diogenes looking attentively at a pile of human bones, and Diogenes explained, I'm searching for the bones of your father, but cannot distinguish them from those of a slave. So yes, he was a bit of a brave man, old Diogenes, but also a bit of a gadfly like Socrates, obviously, as Ben said there. All right, so I'll continue on. No, thank you. Interrupt when you've got something good to say. It doesn't happen that often, so enjoy it when it does.
I've been practicing.
Okay, so the Socratic method. It is more than likely that an argument between proponents will go back and forth. In this sense, it can be thought of as a dialectic inquiry. The Socratic method is a form of dialectic that, in its stricter sense, isn't of much use in real life. However, it is worth discussing given its historical importance and as a precursor for a more loose version which is of greater practical use in humbug hunting. Essentially, the Socratic method is a running dialogue between two people, one taking a lead role in a question and answer format. The purpose is to establish the truth of a matter under consideration by proposition, contradiction of the proposition, repetition of this process, and then eventual synthesis, the truth. In its strict sense, the requirement is for both people to have an agreed-upon topic, to remain on topic, and to proceed by question from the lead person and response from the minor person. The lead looks for fallacies and contradictions in the minor's responses, which are then used to drive the discussion forward until, eventually, the truth of the matter is attained. The non-strict interpretation, which is entirely more useful, is any kind of thorough question and answer dialogue, with all involved agreeing to answer the questions and to keep the goalposts firmly in place. This sets up the ground rules for a discussion and requires a strong lead who refuses to allow the dialogue to go off topic and will not tolerate non-answers. So perhaps even this interpretation is somewhat unrealistic. The best example of this is actually the epitome of its converse. Any interview with any politician, any time in the past, present, and future. The second best example is any excellent teacher asking a series of questions to a bright student. As a tool for truth-seeking, the Socratic method is useful in particular domains of knowledge, in ethics and epistemology, for example, but not usually science. And even then, the Socratic method will more than likely not yield the truth. It is best viewed as a tool used to clarify ideas, spin other hypotheses, defend a position, and remove contradictions and fallacies from that position. Much like playing the devil's advocate, the Socratic method is guaranteed to keep you on your toes and challenge unthinking dogmatism.
So what you were saying, Theo, is that it's pretty much that the Socratic method is the difference between, like, what you did, the distinction it is to explain there is the difference between empiricism and rationalism. So the Socratic method is rational rather than empirical.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. At the end bit there, yeah, about, as yeah, opposed to in science.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. And the main point of bringing that in the book is it is historically important, but also I think, you know, one thing I've noticed in just arguing with people about stuff, or even in, you know, meetings in a workplace and things like that, it's really important, I think, to clarify what you're talking about and the topic you're talking about and not let it shift. And to actually, one thing I found a technique works really well is to say back to the person what they said to you, so they know you were listening and you understand them, and you get clarity on that. And actually, Daniel Dennett actually talked about it in his book. I haven't read his book, but I've heard an interview with him talking about it. Intuition pumps. That's one of the things he talks about. And that's essentially a part of the Socratic method, which is to say, is this what you mean? And then the objective there is for them to say, yeah, you nailed it. That's, you said it even better than me. Because then you can actually then move the conversation forward.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the reason putting there. But of course, in more of a pragmatic way in real life, because the Socratic method, you know, the dialogues are scripted out, and that never happens in real life. But if you've got that in the back of your mind to an approach, it can be quite useful to keep things on topic.
Yeah. If you happen to be one of those boring people who tries to read any sort of enlightenment philosophy, a lot of the enlightenment philosophers engage in this method where they have two characters who engage in
I really like that. People should do more of it. Like, I've read a lot of the Galileo stuff when I was teaching physics.
People like Hume and Berkeley, it's like the Socratic method. Two protagonists engage in a dialectic, and they try and, obviously biased for their own opinion. But
yeah, well, have you read any of the Galileo stuff?
No, I can't. I'd say honestly,
it's awesome, because he actually, one of the characters is called Simplicio.
Oh, okay.
And basically, that's what one of the reasons he basically got arrested, you know, under house arrest, because not only did he talk about it, he named the character who believed the current dogma Simplicio.
Yeah.
So he actually bit of a veiled insult, not so veiled insult there.
Yeah. I suppose.
Yeah, I think Galileo had three characters, I think, from recollection, not two, but yeah.
So, what was I going to say? No, that's all I had to say.
Well, actually, in a way, if you think about all the examples I pretty much use in the book, two characters talking, arguing back and forth. You know, now normally they don't argue about get onto the resolving it, but they you know, one person comes out with a fallacy in their discussion with another person, because I mean that's in reality what happens. But yeah, the reason why I brought that up for this episode is because it does kind of lead into these two example clips I've got. And so the first one, there's a politics podcast here called Politics with Michelle Grattan, and it's for the Conversation website. And the Conversation is like a news kind of website, but it's actually written or an analysis website for lay people. But it's written by academics.
And it's just started in America as well.
Oh, it's a great idea because basically what it's allowing is academics and researchers to write stories and news and analyses and so on about current affairs or research, but out for the general public, and so you actually get what the experts think about a particular topic. Michelle Grattan, she was actually a journalist, but now I think she's a professor of political science or journalism somewhere, but she does a weekly podcast where she interviews a lot of current Australian politicians.
I think she's at ANU, I think.
Australian National University. But anyway, she won a few weeks back. You had an interview with Brian Schmidt, the astronomer and also Nobel laureate, and he's a council member on the Australian Academy of Science, and he was talking to Michelle about climate change, and she specifically asked him, how do you approach talking to people who don't believe in anthropogenic climate change? So I just really thought his response was, he just nailed how you should talk to these kinds of people. So let's have a listen to that.
When you meet people who are sceptical about the science of climate change, what do you say to them?
So it depends completely who they are. If they're actually a scientific expert in the thing, then I'm going to listen to them. Now, there aren't very many people who I consider scientific experts who are genuinely skeptical of climate change. But the whole point of science is to hear people who are experts out and let them engage in the scientific debate. And that should not change. If it's someone who is less expert, then I like to go through more about the philosophy of science, about how science goes, and why shouldn't the average person believe the panel of experts rather than the individuals. I'm also always interested to hear their point of view, and normally I have enough knowledge myself as a non-expert to, I think, diffuse some of their misconceptions, depending on exactly what they are. So it's always meant to be a conversation. I don't think shouting them and telling them that they're a bad person is the right way to go. I think it's trying to lower the level of confusion.
Yeah, so I think the way he ended that there, it's always a conversation, and I think that nailed it. But then he changes the conversation depending on the audience. You know, he adapts it for the audience.
Well, I suppose the best thing I've discovered when you're talking with people who believe or who have unconventional positions on things is to the way I always approach it is to ask them, how did they decide that that was the case? What was their lead me? You ask them to lead you through the process by which they arrived at that conclusion, and get them to explain it to you.
That's actually a good approach for one little little quote that I always remember. You can't reason a person out of a position they didn't reason themselves into.
That's right, yeah.
So if they do that and they can't explain, then you're like, oh, well, we probably don't need to even have this conversation because I know I'm not going to be able to reason with you. But if they didn't explain it, then you've got a common ground to start from.
Yeah, so I have a friend who indulges in every kind of possible conspiracy theory imaginable. And so whenever he gets his on his soapbox about 9/11 or the lizard people or whatever, I always like stop him there and I ask him about how he got to that. Explain to me how you reasoned that conclusion. Lead me through the process by which you arrive at that.
Name names, who is it? Is it
Adam? No, you don't know him, so
sorry, Adam, I don't think you believe that. you've got a friend, sure. So that's the most implausible thing I heard.
Yeah,
so
I know.
You claim to have a friend. Exactly. And that's the point of it. And then it's a conversational, it's not confrontational. And actually, you're asking them the questions. And that's when usually it makes, because if you go on the attack with why you think they're wrong, without hearing why they think they're wrong. Whereas what you actually do is ask them questions, and then you can come back and say, well, actually, you know, this is a reason for it happening. If I even go throw it back to the previous episode, we were talking about some of the curriculum school education stuff. You know, one of the common things is one of the issues is that the numbers are dropping out, and you know that always gets fed back to me. You go, well, actually, the data doesn't support that, and you can show them the data, and that makes them change their mind a little bit. Or some common misconceptions people have, as Brian Schmidt was saying there, you know, he's a non-expert, but he's a scientist and an astronomer. So he obviously has a pretty good understanding of some of the, you know, certainly the big picture stuff. So I mean, if someone has a common misconception, he can correct that quite easily.
He's a physicist, and climate change is physics.
Yeah, that's right. And if it's some, you know, like if it's something, oh, I heard that the sun spots are what's warming up the earth. He's in the position where he can explain why that's a misconception.
Or
said, oh, it's unequivocally, no, this is correct, then you're going to immediately get people offside, get their back up. Whereas this approach is gentle, and it's following them down a path, and it's having an engaged conversation. You're not going to change their mind then and there, but you might plant some seeds that hopefully can move them in that direction in the future.
Yeah, so it's like, it's basically, it's forcing people to justify their position, I suppose.
Well, it actually goes back to another section in the book, and there's a section in the book that we've got called, I can't remember the name of it now, but it's basically, what are you saying, and how do you know what you're saying is true?
Yeah, exactly. You know,
the two fundamental questions of philosophy, which is meaning and justification. You know, if you think about, if you had to describe what philosophy is about, those are the two things I'd talk about. Philosophy is about meaning, and it's about justification. And, you know, and you can crash around epistemology and all that kind of stuff. But that's why I phrase it as, what are you saying? And why do you believe what you're saying is true? So fundamentally in that conversation, you're going to say to them, look, I just want to be clear about, you know, so, you know, with climate change denial, are you denying that the climate changes? Are you denying that you agree the climate changes, but you're denying that it's humans that are doing it?
Sorry, okay, sorry, Theo, if I can just butt in there. I also add a third corollary to that is like...
There's only two.
No, there's a third one. There's a third one. It's like, what are you saying? Sorry, what was it again?
Why do you believe what you're saying is true? Yeah.
And then the third one, which kind of flows from the other two, is like, why...
you're wrong. Yeah. No, sorry, that's my one.
is why is that important?
Yeah, that's a good one.
How
is
it non-trivial?
Yep.
So, obviously, there's a certain amount of... subjectiveness involved in that final point, but I mean, there's a lot of things that are trivial that are not worth wasting our time arguing about as well.
Oh yeah, definitely, absolutely. Yeah, well, and that's actually that distinction I actually use it about whether it's okay to use fallacies or not. So one of the things, of course, with fallacies is once you learn them, you can use them for evil. And fundamentally, when it comes to being a seeker after truth, I'm happy to be a hypocrite and to, make jokes about things and to not take things seriously. But when it is something serious, then actually that's when you need to be a seeker after truth and be interested in the process and not care about the answer so much. Yeah. And that certainly comes back to that importance bit where is it, you know, and that, but of course that comes into philosophy in general, is there's a lot of, or even research in general, there's a lot of research that you kind of go, well, okay, I suppose I can see how you might be interested in that. I'm not sure what use that is to anything, but of course, that's a part of the whole research process is letting people research stuff because you just never know. Just don't go reading a lot of PhDs in the Faculty of Arts or the Faculty of Education because then you might get a little bit depressed by some of the titles.
Or the Faculty of Philosophy, Theo. Let's not mince
words. Yeah, but at least philosophy owns it. You know, they're not even trying to be useful a lot of the time, but... some of the others act like they are, and you can't get them.
I'm not sure which is worse.
Yeah. intellectual wankery is always good fun. But look, so yeah, and to me, that's one clear just process to go through, which is just to talk to someone, to engage with them, to find out what they're thinking, try and correct some misconceptions, find out where they're at. The other clip I've got actually comes from the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. So I'm sure most of the listeners to this will be familiar with this podcast. They were talking about an approach that I've actually used myself in the past and really has hit home to me since I've been in education, the education bureaucracy, because of being on the inside and then seeing how it gets talked about on the outside. This is something that's really become clear to me. And all, the same thing happened for you and I, Ben, when you were on the inside of working in a government department and understanding how the policies work and understand the environmental policies and so on. So anyway, this is just a lead into it. So let's have a listen to the clip about them talking about expertise and how to approach talking to people about their lack of expertise in a particular subject.
Why is it that so many people have an opinion that differs from the scientific community? Do they not know what the scientific community believes, or do they reject it? And if they reject it, they're essentially saying that they know better than the experts. And that is such an arrogant position. You know what I mean? Which, of course, usually they're the ones accusing others of being arrogant. So what I like to do is ask people to consider an area of their expertise. But think about anything that you're an expert on. What does the general public know about it?
Sure.
Do you think the general public has a pretty good handle on your area of expertise? No, I've yet to meet anybody who would say yes to that question. Meanwhile, like if they're a mechanic, you know, what do you think about your average customer and their knowledge about how to be a good mechanic? Well, they would know from experience that it's terrible. You know, that if you're not an expert in something, your knowledge about it is probably pretty wanting. because you're just absorbing what you can from the culture, which, and TV and media, you know, which is incredibly inaccurate about any area that's even remotely sophisticated. Mm-hmm. But again, that's why I used like your own area of expertise. What are you? It doesn't matter what it is. You're an expert on phishing lures. It doesn't matter. Whatever you're an expert on, just think about the gap between your knowledge and the average person in the street. Well, as ignorant as you think they are, that's how ignorant you are about everything else in the world.
Right. So yeah, dope. Think of any time something is shown in a film or on TV that
you happen to know about,
and you happen to know about it. You will every single person, whether it's a mechanic or making fishing lures or a makeup artist or an astronaut, they will go, "Oh, jeez, really? That's really no, that's not how it works." Every time. Very rarely does a film come out where it's like, wow, that was really spot on. That was really well done. You know, those are the exceptions. So yeah, so that's exactly a great way to think of it. Like whenever you see your expertise done in popular culture, it's usually done wrong. And why? Because you know a lot about it. Well, you know that little about everything else on the planet.
Everything else.
Yeah, that's great. Right.
Yeah, so the reason why that really struck home for me is because that I was really my experience working in education, you know, and reading a lot of the research and being involved in the development of curriculum and the Australian national curriculum and so on, and then hearing the bloviations and the opinions of the people in the media and then just the general public and realizing, and, you know, journalists, and realizing they have absolutely no idea what they're talking about and getting it completely wrong. And then I figure, well, I don't know about X, Y, and Z, so my opinions on those things must basically be either wrong or just completely ill-informed as to me. So my default position should be, I don't know. And so I've since used that as an approach when talking to people about stuff to say exactly what, you know, what they're talking about there, which is, well, I know about this stuff and I see how the media reports it and they get it completely wrong. What's something you know about? And they'll say, well, how did the media go with that? And they go, oh, they get it wrong. And I say, how did normal people talk about it? They get it wrong. I say, ergo, if you think the doctor is treating you badly about something because you read something on the internet about it, well, how the hell would you know? They've gone to like 8 years or 9 years of medical school, that level of expertise. So obviously it's your right as a consumer to get other opinions and so on. But if those other opinions also tell you the same thing, it's so undeniably arrogant. And the same with climate change, you know, so arrogant to assume that you would know more than the expert and that your point of view is more valid or just as valid as their point of view.
You know what? This is a perfect time to introduce or reintroduce our audience to the Dunning-Kruger effect, Theo.
Yeah, exactly. And that's actually what Steve Novella there actually mentioned, the Dunning-Kruger effect, before I edited it out. Exactly that. Yep, exactly. Yep.
So for people...
Yeah, the arrogance of ignorance, yeah.
So for people who don't know what the Dunning-Kruger effect is, it's basically people are ignorant of their own ignorance.
Yep.
Which is pretty much precisely what that was Steve Novella in the interview, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly what Steve was saying.
Yeah, it's basically the ignorance of one's ignorance is the malady of ignorance. Like, I've got that quote from somewhere else, I've stolen it, but I love that quote because that is a Dunning-Kruger effect. The good thing about, the reason why it's studied, because people have known this basically, but Dunning and Kruger actually studied it empirically and got the data and demonstrated how it works, you know, and demonstrated the circumstances in which it works. And you have to have some level of competence to realize how big your gap is between true expertise and where you're currently at.
And the thing is as well, say for example, I used to work in environmental policy. I wouldn't really consider myself I was an expert in a very narrow area, but even then I've got a kind of an indication of how little I know, you know what I mean? So being an expertise just grants you a bigger scope of the known unknowns, I suppose, to go back to.
Yes, that. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So you kind of get a better appreciation for what it is that you don't know.
Yeah, and also get appreciation for even in that field, like what things, even if I'm not an expert in those things, but what things do I know that other people who are experts
that's right. So
have confirmed, so I can kind of believe them, you know, that kind of thing.
So even
that's why, as a as someone who understands science, I understand how science works. I'm very comfortable deferring to scientific experts because I understand the basic processes of science, and even the, you know, I know there's bias in the way science is done because science is a human activity, but it is the only way we've ever done stuff that's naturally self-correcting.
Well, that's the entire point. It's set up to try and negate the human tendency to bias things. So.
That's right, yeah. And it might fool us over a period of time, but eventually it self-corrects. Yeah, and again, as far as a way to approach things, it's the best way we've got, so you've got to go with it. And so stuff like climate change, you know, I'm pretty damn confident because of the overwhelming confidence of the scientific community. But yeah, you know, the other thing about this is really important to acknowledge, and it actually goes back to the Socratic wisdom type stuff as well, is the Dunning-Kruger effect is not necessarily related to just intelligence, because it might be a part of it, but for example, one of our favorite guys, Sam Harris, remember when he got into an argument around security checking what's it called when you're determined to pick racial profiling and profiling people. Yeah. And he didn't know what he was talking about and got into big arguments with Bruce. But he still never acknowledged it, you know.
Yeah.
And because he's really smart, like he's a smart guy, but he's a neuroscientist, you know. So stick to neuroscience. You know, I get you want to write about other things, but when it comes to security, you can have some basic conversation, but you've got to acknowledge I'm not an expert in it. So, that comes back to that Socratic wisdom, because Socrates, you know, he went and talked to the great artists and the great poets and the great people, and because they were great in this one area and they were smart people, they assumed that they were great in other areas. And I actually saw a good example of it on the new HBO series. I think it's HBO, Better Call Saul, which, you know, is based on the Breaking Bad series. And the character Saul's a lot, for people who don't know, although I imagine most people have seen Breaking Bad, but he's a lawyer and he's got an older brother who's actually suffering from electric fields, whatever the hell it's called, where you think you get sick from electric fields, electromagnetic fields.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Electromagnetic hypersensitivity disorder, whatever, which basically has been studied now and it's demonstrated to be a nocebo effect.
Like people who are allergic to wind farms and stuff like that.
Yeah. So it's basically been pretty conclusively shown to be a nocebo effect, where because they have people in a controlled test environment and they put the electric fields off and on them, and you know, they'll tell them the field's on when it isn't, they'll tell them the field's off when it is on, and then they do every combination and they analyze the data. But anyway, the argument that Saul made is he's so smart, he's smarter than you. He's saying this to the doctor, he's the smartest person here. So therefore it must be real. And it's like, mate, just because you're smart doesn't mean you can't be fooled. You know, there are scientists who've been fooled by magicians to believe in ESP. So, smartness got nothing to do with it sometimes. Well, it's the arrogance of ignorance.
I think, years and years ago, Michael Shermer wrote a book called Why Smart People Believe Stupid Things, or something like that.
Oh, yeah, something like that.
I don't know if this is true or not, but what he actually said is that intelligence, or being intelligent, is actually not, does not immunize you against getting sucked into things. What it does is it allows you to be better at post hoc justification for
rationalizing
why you believe in some crazy thing or something else.
Yeah, it's far harder to argue with a smart person about conspiracy theories than a dumb person.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've experienced that so many times now, and that's why I think it's really important to learn the skeptical tools for thinking early on, because you still might get the wrong answer, but if you're married to the process, not to the answer, you're going to be less likely to rationalize. So you're going to rationalize when you care about the answer, and there's all the investment sunk cost fallacy and all those things. So if you've invested in something emotionally, then to change your mind is much more difficult. So if you invest in the answer. So again, going back to what we were talking about that previous episode with the terrorism stuff, like I had been sucked into the kind of the just constant bombardment of Islamic fundamentalism and terrorism and suicide bombing and so on. But because I wasn't married to the answer that, you know, it's fundamentally about the religious doctrine of Islam is why people are killing each other. And then I heard that guy talking about, well, actually, the root cause probably is more to do with occupation. I'm like, oh, okay. And of course, it's more complicated than that. But that helped me. It was quite straightforward after a little bit. Like, it did take me a little while. I didn't want to believe him. when I listened to it, but I went and read his paper. I'm like, mate, this is pretty conclusive. He's got some good data here. So happy to change my mind. And that way, of course, if you're happy to change your mind, you're never wrong. So I quite appreciate that as well.
Yeah, well, there is that famous quote by Maynard Keynes. It's like, when the data changes, I change my mind. What do you?
Yeah, do, yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, it might have been him. Yeah. So when the Keynes? Facts change, yeah, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? Yeah, something like that. Yeah. We'll leave that as an exercise to the listener to look that one up. Yeah, so,
I could
yeah.
be just lying, and I could have just made it up right now. But
no, that quote definitely exists. I don't know who made it, but yeah, no, John Maynard Keynes. There
John
you go.
Maynard Keynes. Yeah.
Look at you, mate. On fire.
On fire.
How good is your memory?
I've been practicing.
Yeah, but that's a great quote, because that's again it, and to go back to something we commonly talk about, politics as well. Being a politician, you're in such a hard place because you're not allowed to change your mind because you're breaking a promise, So that's one of the things to emphasize more to skeptics, is to be more forgiving of that, because we've got to let people change their mind, and if they change their mind for obvious good reason, then we need to say congratulate them on that, and then really emphasize what a great thing it is to change your mind, and what a great thing it is to say I don't know.
Yeah,
I think that's the most important thing.
A perfect example of this recently, Theo, is I don't know how much you know about Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah.
But he was resolutely anti-genetic engineering. I don't know.
If you saw him changing a chapter in his book, wasn't there?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw him on Bill Maher. What's Bill Maher's? Is it Question Time? His program that he has.
Yeah, Bill Maher.
Bill Maher. Yep.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Well, anyway, he's dead.
Real time. He was dead
against genetic engineering for all the usual, strange propaganda reasons. And anyway, so he's actually from public. I don't know. Criticism/ridicule from his peers. He actually hats off to him. He went back and has looked at all the arguments, and he's actually come out and changed his mind about it.
Yeah, well, he actually went and talked to geneticists.
That's
and
right.
Went
yeah.
and saw what they did and that kind yeah. of stuff. Yeah, it's amazing what yeah. happens when you actually go and investigate something and talk yeah. to the experts.
And I mean, hats off to him as well. It's like he's
yep. Yeah, well, that's one thing that, and apologies to any fellow Oscarian skeptics who are listening here. That's one thing that really disappointed me a few years ago with the Australian skeptics, was when they gave the wooden spoon, the bent spoon award to the Australian Curriculum and Assessment Authority for the science curriculum they were working on, because they had some issues around some of the way the wording of the curriculum was written, and they felt like the creationism could get taught or something like that. And a lot of the educators who are skeptics, teachers and me as well, were extremely, when we found out that happened, we're just like flabbergasted, because it showed a fundamental misunderstanding of how curriculum works.
Yeah.
And not only that, it was a draft document that had been put out for public consultation. So the actual curriculum authority had put out a document for open, transparent public consultation. So if anything, you should be applauding that and saying you're being transparent and open. And then if they don't respond to the feedback and don't change it, then you can criticize them. But they actually did respond to the feedback and change them. So I was really appalled when that happened. And, they said they'd look at it again. And as far as I know, I could be wrong, but last time I checked, they hadn't changed the thing. And they got a lot of feedback from people who knew what they were talking about. And they refused to change their mind. So, again, it's that assumption that, it's education. I can know about that because I went to school. And it just showed a fundamental ignorance of how curriculum works, how curriculum is delivered in schools in Australia, and the actual process for developing the curriculum was meant to get that kind of response. A response was meant to say, is this okay? Is this what the public thinks should be taught and how it should be taught? And then they responded to that properly by actually removing some of the things that people were critical of. So, but they still got the Bent Spoon Award, which is given to people who give out bloody... armbands for balancing, making your balance well and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so,
get those? I haven't seen one for a long time.
They got sued out of the Australian ACCC, shut them down. Yeah, they had to give back their money as well. But, the anti-vaxxers get the Bent Spoon Award. And so to me, the disappointing thing was it would have been a great opportunity to demonstrate proper seeking, truth-seeking, and actually say, look, we thought this. Some experts have come along and told us we're not quite right, so we're changing our mind and we're actually going to going to give the award to this other person, you know, and which I think actually what had, did have the those armbands were up that year. So that to me was such a great opportunity to demonstrate, you know, skepticism in action, which is a part of that is changing your mind. But they didn't take that up. So I was pretty disappointed when that happened. I've got to say, I actually stopped subscribing for about a year or two after that because I was a bit annoyed. But I've since subscribed again. I never read The Skeptic when it comes out. I should just start reading again because I get it as a PDF. So one of those things, I put it in my reading list and then I never get around to reading it. But on other news, I might be talking at the Skeptics Conference in Brisbane this year. So there we go. Maybe I'll talk about that. That'll be fun.
You should, man. It's like...
I might. That'll really test out the skepticism then, won't it?
Yeah, no, I reckon you should.
All right, and then when I get hauled off stage with the big wooden cane, I can blame you.
You can blame me.
Ben told me to do it.
I'll sit in the front row and ask you some Dorothy Dixes.
Yeah, well, like we remember when we did that, we were at university together.
That's right.
The course on, was it the course on Darwin, the Darwin course?
And
it was on evolution or something.
That's right.
And
Darwin's dangerous idea or something, wasn't it?
And we both set each other up with, we both were in the seminar audiences and set each other up with easy, with really convoluted esoteric questions.
Which would demonstrate.
And this is for our benefit. Yeah, I think I was doing it on Darwin's dangerous idea and, I think I got you to ask me a question about some ancient Greek philosopher that no one would have heard of. And, of course, we researched it all up. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. I believe it was blah, blah, blah. I don't know that our lecturer twigged to that, but he may have. He may have worked out we'd set each other up. Anyway, we both did very well in that subject. Not a surprise. I think the main thing to take away from this episode, I think, is think about if you're talking with people who don't hold your position on something, think about the approach to talking them, and being confrontational and antagonistic and negative is never going to work. It'll just get people's backs up. But if you think about approaching it in a way that's calm and reasoned and engaging them in conversation, and then one little tactic when it comes to, you know, why don't you believe what an expert thinks, approach it from the way they're talking about there in The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is, well, what are you an expert in? What do you think the general public knows about that? Well, hang on, that's what you know about the topic we're talking about. You don't know anything about it, so why would you not believe what the experts say? You've got to have a better reason than just, oh, I don't believe them because I don't believe them.
Truthiness.
Well, is that truthiness?
Truthiness, yeah. I believe in the gut.
Yeah, gut feeling.
Go with the gut.
You've moved me on to another one. I just actually heard, I was listening to a podcast about the Cricket World Cup, and they were talking, and it reminds me of another episode we did recently on the review technology with the technology. And they were talking about a decision where a batsman was given out for LBW. And again, sorry, American listeners, I'm not going to explain it, but basically it's the ball, the trajectory of the ball is calculated by the computer tracking software. And they were saying, the trajectory said it wasn't out, but my gut feeling, sometimes you just know it's out. It's like, well, actually, I'm going to put my money on the computer trajectory tracking software over your gut feeling of whether the ball was going to hit the stumps. I'm sorry. So, yeah, it's that classic. It's a gut feeling. It's like, you just know. No, you don't just know. That's the point.
Yeah, it's like saying use the force, isn't it?
Oh, well, that's true, right?
Midichlorians.
Midichlorians, yeah. I did actually fool a bunch of kids once about my abilities with the force. back when I was still teaching, and like smartphones and that thing were just, and phones were just kind of new for kids to even have them. And of course, the school had a no phones at school rule, and so I had a PDA, you know, a pocket PDA, what do they call, personal digital assistant. And of course, they had Bluetooth on them, and a lot of phones just started getting Bluetooth, but people didn't really realize they had Bluetooth on their phones and just left them on. And so some of the kids had their phones in their pockets, and one of the students had named their phone after themselves, but it wasn't in my class, it was in another teacher's class. So in the middle of my lesson, I wandered out of my lesson just because I'd looked on my PDA and seen this kid's name, and wandered to this other class and said, asked the teacher, oh, sorry to interrupt. I said, is there a student here called? And I called out the kid's name. And they go, yes. And I said, stand up. The kid stood up and said, take your phone out of your pocket. And then this kid had to take the phone out of the pocket. I'm like, I said, don't mess with me. I've got the force. And the kids just couldn't, they didn't have a clue how I did it, because this was back in like 2004 or five. So they didn't, because most kids didn't even have a phone. And if they had one, they wouldn't have had it in their pocket because they wouldn't have confiscated. Now, of course, every kid's got a phone in their pocket. But back then, it was just a rare occurrence. And they just were free. And the teacher just jaw dropped. And I'm just like, and you know, I was in the middle of a lesson. It wasn't the beginning of a lesson or anything like that. But that, and I've done that. And another trick I used to do with the force as well was when I was teaching, if you see kids chewing gum, what you do is you don't, and this is a hot tip for anyone who's going to be a teacher, you don't call the kid on the gum chewing when you see it. You wait a bit longer. And then when you're writing on the blackboard or the whiteboard and your back's turned, that's when you say, John, get that gum out of your mouth. And it just, you know, kids, they're so dumb. They fall for anything. They're like, how'd you see that? And say, oh, I sensed it. A few little tricks like that always work. It's just basic being a magician, you know, like basic sleight of hand stuff. But yeah. So the force is true, Ben. Long story
short. It is, yeah.
All right. Look, another fairly longish episode. So I hope you enjoyed it. And look again, if thank you for anyone who's gone on and bought a copy of the book or gone and rated the podcast on iTunes or tweeted about it or something like that. Any little bit of help we can get to spread the word is fantastic. So thank you very much if you've gone and done that. The rest of you, I'll forgive you for being lazy.
Dead
I know
to me.
What it's like.
Theo, I was going to say they're dead to us, except if they bought your book, which would be more than make up for
awesome.
That. Yeah.
Like, if you bought my book, you're a very smart, good-looking person.
Yeah. And if they wanted to be...
www.skepticsfieldguide.net.
Oh, you beat me to it. I was going to say if they
yeah,
wanted
I knew.
To...
I've got the force, man, I told
you.
Jedi mind trick, something like that. Okay. All right, thanks, Ben, and we'll see you the next episode.
Yeah, thanks, Theo. We'll see you next time.
Okay.